Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Silicon Valley is home to some of the most powerful companies in the world. The area that was once known for silicon chip manufacturing giants is now synonymous with household names like Apple, Google, and Facebook. The growth of internet and tech companies is turning them into big players on Capitol Hill as Congress considers a number of bills on issues like online privacy, broadband spectrum, internet privacy, and corporate taxation. According to data from OpenSecrets.org, last year, computer and internet industries spent more than $125 million on lobbying. And with the presidential race in full swing, tech companies are also contributing to super PACs and presidential campaigns. President Obama's campaign has raised $1.4 million through May from employees of 15 of the top tech companies. So what do they want for their return on investment? On today's Your Call, we are continuing our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about Silicon Valley's political power. What are their top issues? Today, we're joined by Michelle Quinn. She is a Silicon Valley-based technology correspondent for Politico, and her latest piece is called Silicon Valley Pushes Policy Goals. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Rob Cox. He's editor of Breaking Views, the global financial commentary service of Reuters in New York. Rob is also a contributor to Newsweek, and his Newsweek piece, The Ruthless Overlords of Silicon Valley, created quite a stir a couple of months ago. Hi, Rob. Welcome to the show. Hello, Rob. We'll connect with Rob in just a couple minutes. So, Michelle, why don't we start off with you? We did a show last week about Amazon.com and talked about their political agenda and the fact that they don't get that much scrutiny, sort of like a Walmart does, for example. And we got such a great response. And so that's why we wanted to do this show and speak more broadly about Silicon Valley. So first off, let's talk a little bit about just the money that they're giving to D.C. OpenSecrets.org found that last year, computer and internet companies spent more than $125 million on lobbying. Who are some of the biggest players?
When you look at big players, and I was wondering about those numbers, it sounds like they've also included telecommunications companies in that, AT&T, Verizon. But beyond those companies, the biggest players are, as you mentioned, Microsoft, Google, IBM, Intel. And this is relatively new. A lot of people in the Bay Area know that for a long time, the tech industry really hasn't been that engaged with federal policy and a little bit in state policy or in terms of lobbying as well. That began to change in the mid-90s. There was an effort to try to speak with one voice or try to get the tech industry to speak with one voice and start to participate more with politics and fundraising. That has been a slow go. However, in the past couple of years, it's really changed. Google's PAC was one of the biggest supporters of Obama 2008 campaign, for example. So it's something that's, I think the industry is getting to see what it's creating. It's slowly getting used to the idea that it needs to participate. And at the same time, I don't think it's comfortable with being a big player in Washington.
And what would you say are some of their top issues? Go ahead, Michelle.
I would say the top issues are... they have this idea of the innovation economy and innovation agenda, which is anything that's good for companies to either have access to capital, meaning money, or being able to have access to talent, meaning, skilled graduates from top American universities or skilled engineers and other people from around the world. So mobility of capital and of talent are kind of the two biggest issues for Silicon Valley, and lots of things fall under those two rubric, and probably a lot of things fall outside of it too. So, for example, one thing that tech companies, big and small, really want is changes in immigration law, so that people can hire talented people from other countries, bring them to the U.S., or bring talent employees they've already hired to the U.S. So flexibility in terms of talent. Same thing with capital money. So those are the two main things. Some things they're getting and some things they're not getting. So I wouldn't I'd be careful to describe them as kind of succeeding on all fronts.
Participating
more than they used to be.
And we'll talk about specifics later in the show, but I understand we actually have some news that they got a patent office just recently in Silicon Valley. Can you talk about that?
This is a huge piece of news for Silicon Valley. And it's kind of funny to me because, Silicon Valley has lobbied for about 3.5 years, even more, that it really wants to have a satellite patent and trademark office in the Valley somewhere. And to me, it's kind of funny because, in this age of digitization and telecommunicating and all these things, the idea that we really needed a physical plant or physical office right here near us was sort of quaint and old-fashioned, and yet I do understand the argument. And the argument is this region is the number one place where patents are awarded, and that more can be done for innovation if there's more interaction between patent examiners and innovators themselves, and that maybe even the innovators can help the patent office stay up to date and kind of get through its backlog really quickly. So over the weekend, it was announced that Silicon Valley is going to be one of three new patent satellite offices, the others being the Denver area and Dallas-Fort Worth. And this is just, a huge deal for Silicon Valley.
And who was behind the push for a patent office in Silicon Valley?
It was all the tech, kind of the big tech industry groups. So Silicon Valley Leadership Group played a very important role and kind of pushed for this for years. Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, TechNet, which is a technology industry organization, and others. And I think also I'd be remiss if I don't include the mayor of San Jose. So they worked really hard. Meanwhile, there were other applications. There were about 500 applications around the U.S. for this, including a bunch from Silicon Valley, one from Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. So there was a big effort in California on multiple fronts. There was some from Southern California as well for this kind of office. And it's a great thing for the Valley in the sense that it kind of immediately just is like recognition. Yes, we understand you are the innovation capital. But there's also a criticism of the tech industry in general and our economy in the Bay Area that we kind of create that high-level job, but we're not creating a lot of sort of, kind of government jobs that may be not the same as the kind of the tech CEO, the tech engineer, but other kinds of jobs in our economy, so that we have this sort of bifurcated economy in the Bay Area. And this kind of addresses some of that, which is, look, we can have more diverse economy here.
And that is Michelle Quinn. She's a Silicon Valley-based tech correspondent for Politico. You can find her latest piece, Silicon Valley Pushes Policy Goals, at yourcallradio.org. And now I would like to welcome Rob Cox to the show. Rob is editor of Breaking Views, the global financial commentary service of Reuters. He's also a contributor to Newsweek. Hi, Rob. Welcome to the show. Sorry we had some problems with you earlier.
That's no problem.
So I wanted to talk about the piece you wrote for Newsweek because it got so much attention and a lot of people really did not like, well, specifically the headline of your piece, The Ruthless Overlords of Silicon Valley. And you've got this great line in here. It says, the truth is, it's increasingly tough for the establishment of Silicon Valley to argue that their business is any less evil or does any more good than the bulk of corporate America. Yeah. Underneath the language of moral superiority lies the same profit motive that drives all businesses and a ruthlessness rivaling history's greatest industrial bullies.
Yes, yes. No, I made a lot of friends in Silicon Valley with that particular piece. But, I think what we're talking about here is trying to gain influence in Washington. And that is a perfect symptom of what corporate America does. This is how corporate America behaves. It spends a lot of money on lobbying. It spends a lot of money on PAC donations. It tries to influence the agenda for its own good, for its own, for the benefit of its shareholders and its employees. I mean, that is just, I'm not saying that's evil. All I'm saying is that is business as usual. And the idea which a lot of these companies have sort of put forward that they are, you know, quote, not a conventional company, which is what Google had said in its letter to shareholders when it went public 8 years ago, or even as Mark Zuckerberg says, simply put, we don't build services to make money. We make money to build better services, and we think this is a good way to build something. These days, I think more and more people want to use services from companies that believe in something beyond simply maximizing profits. Well, that's all well and good, but that's not exactly how they behave. And so, again, the idea isn't that they're evil, but they aren't really necessarily as good as they might have you believe. And I think the fact that they are spending so much money, that Google, for instance, spends, you know, more than, I don't know what it is. I mean, Michelle probably has a better handle on this, but according to Real Clear Politics, it's approaching the kind of money that Microsoft spent. And we all think of Microsoft as this great evil corporation, which was, in fact, beaten up by the U.S. government and Justice Department, suggest to you that they take their role as guardians for their shareholders quite seriously.
And you also point out that Google has 33,000 employees, just as many as Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, I mean there are a lot of similarities. Now, they're in completely different businesses. In fact, Google is a much better business. Think Goldman Sachs. It makes more money per employee than Goldman Sachs does, and we've all or many people have made Goldman Sachs, you know, the great vampire squid that's sucking the lifeblood out of American capitalism. But it is it's kind of funny how similar they are in many ways. They're both under scrutiny by government. Google, in particular, is going to see a lot more heat over the next few years, whether it's antitrust or anti-competitive behavior. Privacy issues, disregard for privacy, indifference to copyright, all of those things are going to, I think we're going to read a lot more about those in the next 5 to 10 years with relation to Google, perhaps even than we read about from the highly, highly regulated business of Wall Street, which is best embodied by the other company that has 33,000 employees, Goldman Sachs.
Well, it's not really surprising that they're spending so much money in D.C., right? Because there's so many different issues that affect them. But your main argument is that what is kind of surprising is that there's not much scrutiny on these companies like there is on, say, for example, Wall Street. And then you've got companies like Apple, who in one of their most famous commercials showed images of Gandhi and Martin Luther King saying things like, you know, you've got to take a chance, think different, change the world.
Right, or even 1984. Do you remember way back when Apple was sort of, you know, proposing this universe where Big Brother would be watching us all? But the funny thing is, of course, that you know the iPhone is the ultimate device for figuring out what people are doing, what they're thinking, where they are at any moment in time, and it's really how that they manage that power that they have, or how people like Google, who famously a couple of months ago had allowed, had created an application whereby, you know, it was overriding Safari, the search engine on iPhones, overriding privacy settings, which is extraordinary, right? I mean, they are basically breaking the rules. But that's right. I mean, so it's not surprising that Google has a lot at stake here. And so they hired Susan Molinari, who's a well-known former congresswoman from Staten Island, quite combative. They've hired her to basically run their lobbying efforts in Washington. By the way, Facebook has done something similar with Joe Lockhart, who used to be in the Clinton administration. They've all beefed up heavily inside the Beltway. And they do have specific causes. I mean, they're not necessarily, you know, awful causes or anything. Don't get me wrong. I mean, they're looking at things like extending H-1B visas so that you can bring in really highly qualified or keep really highly qualified immigrants working in the country. There's a lot of people from both sides of the aisle who think that's a very smart thing. Telecoms policy, you know, that is one where, you know, they are girding it for a battle with the likes of AT&T and Verizon, who, by the way, spend far more than all these tech companies. But in a sense, given that you could argue that the argument will be between a lot of the telecom providers and people like Google or Facebook, it wouldn't surprise me to see Google, Facebook et al. Start to increase their donations to the level that reach those of Verizon or AT&T, which, I mean, again, I'm not the expert on this, but looking at at some of the numbers, they seem to be among the biggest. I think AT&T had an annual lobbying last year of over $20 million, which is, you know, almost three times what Google did. The other thing, but there are other things like tax repatriation. It's a big, big issue in Silicon Valley and within tech companies broadly, like Cisco. John Chambers, CEO there, has been, you know, banging the table forever to try to reduce the double taxation, as he perceives it, for profits that are repatriated from abroad. So it's, you know, but companies do this. This is what companies do. They spend a lot of money to try to protect their interests. They try to influence legislators, both through lobbying and through individual donations and through PAC donations. And that is, again, just, you know, whether you like it or not, that's how that's legal corruption in this country. And corporations everywhere participate in it. So they're not any more evil for doing so.
Hmm. Well, I'd love to hear listeners on this issue. We got a lot of calls last week during our Amazon show about this very topic, and we'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions about Silicon Valley's political agenda, if you work in Silicon Valley or work in the tech sector, what are your thoughts on where they stand on things like immigration law and corporate taxation? And we'll also find out what are the differences, if any. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And why do you think Wall Street and companies like Walmart are under the microscope? There's so many documentaries and books about them, but not so much about companies like Facebook, for example, or Apple or Amazon. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. What do you think matters most to the people who are calling the shots in Silicon Valley? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Sorry about that, Michelle. You wanted to jump in?
I just wanted to mention that Rob said that I thought was really interesting. Why hasn't Apple spent very much money on politics, tax, obvious, and yet it has a lot of, and it has all the same issues for many of the issues that Google has.
Michelle, we're having some problems with your phone line. We're going to have to call you back. Sorry about that. Rob, Michelle asked, why hasn't Apple spent as much as a company like Google? Because they're facing some of the same issues. Do you know how much Apple has spent?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking at opensecrets.org's numbers. They said that last year they spent about $2.25 million on annual lobbying. To put that in perspective, that's basically, you know, Google spent about almost $10 million. So it is quite a bit less, and it is kind of interesting. I mean, the rap against Apple, quite interestingly, is not so. It's been things like its contract manufacturing in China, right? I mean, the sort of famous Mike Daisy scandal that happened earlier this year, but this whole idea that, you know, that they have exploited the manufacturing plants of Shenzhen and Foxconn in China. And recently changed a lot of the way that they did that. But I think that's, I'm not sure that there's any way you lobby for that. I mean, that is that it's not obvious to me that there's a policy change necessarily that would impact them. So maybe that's why they haven't spent that kind of money, because that's been their big problem. But it is interesting, given, you know, telecommunications policy is quite an important issue for Apple. But, you know, they are the handset maker. They aren't the carrier. And they aren't the operating system or the website, right? They're in the perfect place, in a sense, that it doesn't really matter what happens with Verizon, AT&T, and bandwidth issues. It doesn't necessarily matter what, you know, if those guys try to restrict necessarily Google or whatnot, because Apple is still selling for $499 the device. Of course, it gets subsidies back and forth from the industry, so the industry's fortunes do matter. And secondly, they don't, you know, the more that they have control over the operating system, say the Safari search browser on the iPhone, the better they are. They're better off they are. So they can try to sit back and let these guys battle it out, I
see. Michelle, are you back with us? Did you hear that?
Yeah.
Okay, good. And your line sounds much better. What about the political orientation of the heavy hitters in Silicon Valley? They seem to be more pro Democrat than the usual multinationals, the Chamber of Commerce type businesses. But what kind of Democrats do they tend to be?
I think that's true. And yet, the fascinating thing is that the companies are trying to be more bipartisan in the people they pick. Rob mentioned the hiring of Susan Molinari, and that's just by Google, which was just a great example of Google, which has that kind of at least a perception that it's sort of very Democrat and very big supporters of Obama, that it's trying to balance itself, and that shows a level of sophistication that I don't think that we've seen before from the Valley, which is a recognition that, hey, the Democrats are in, they could be out, they're practically half out right now in the House, and the chances are, you know, there could be a reversal again. So let's make sure we have friends and relationships, because we're in it for the long run. And you see that at Facebook and other companies as well. And I think that's the kind of thing that they're trying to do. They're doing a lot of things like Facebook and Google in particular, where they'll work with congressional offices and leaders to help them with their Facebook pages or websites. Twitter does the same thing. So trying to give some, you know, help spread the tools of what they use is one thing they do. Hiring lobbyists on all sides of the fence is another thing. And then actually hiring people from congressional offices or from the administration that are on both sides of the fence. I think that shows that something's changing there, and I think Facebook in particular has been really good about this.
Well, according to the latest numbers, Democrats got about $1.5 million in the last two federal election years. That's almost twice the amount as Republicans received. And for just information, Netscape co-founder Mark Andreessen has switched to Romney after backing Obama last time around. Rob, what would you like to add about political orientation?
I think it's very much a Democrat kind of town. I mean, you get that sense. I mean, part of it, it's actually veering more libertarian, I noticed, over the years, right? But libertarian Democrat in the sense that you have people like Peter Thiel, who is a sort of, you know, considered a leading intellectual light out in the Silicon Valley capital industry business, right? So he's a guy who's quite libertarian. You know, there are folks out there who talk about creating their own floating islands where they create their own sort of Ayn Randian rules. But generally speaking, I mean, famously, Obama went out and I think he had dinner and there was Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook and Steve Jobs, you know, before he passed away. All the leading lights of the Valley were out there. And, you know, I think he makes a lot of money when he pops into town and does a fundraiser. You know, not unlike when he goes down to Jessica Sarah Parker's house in New York.
Or George Clooney in Malibu.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think he considers it a part of his base. But if, you know, when you do see people like Andreessen turning and you hear a lot of the talk about the very, very idealistic talk about creating sort of new utopian societies, it doesn't necessarily, you know, jibe with either of the parties.
Mm. I'd like to find out who's going to save them if they fall off the island.
Yeah, maybe they have their own, coast guard.
Well, today we are talking about Silicon Valley's political agenda and their political power. This does not get as much scrutiny at all as, say, Wall Street or multinationals like Walmart. So we're talking about where these companies give their money and what they want in return. And we'd love to hear from you. If you work in Silicon Valley, if you breathe Silicon Valley like so many people are so consumed with technology, what do you think about their political agenda? Of course, every company is going to give money, but what is the agenda? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment, yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco, online, KALW.org. Following this broadcast, we present the BBC's World Have Your Say, and then at noon today, it's Philosophy Talk.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. And speaking of technology, tomorrow we'll rebroadcast a conversation we had with Jason Ben-Levy, author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech, Secrets They Won't Tell You About Your Digital Life. Are we consuming digital technology, or is it consuming us? That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about political power in Silicon Valley. According to OpenSecrets.org, last year, computer and internet industries spent more than $125 million on lobbying. So what are their top issues? If you work in technology or if you have any questions about Silicon Valley's political agenda, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from George in San Francisco, who works in Silicon Valley. Hi, George. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi, Ms. Rose. I was just calling because I thought this is sort of by a small stretch. You could also, this is also about the political nature of Silicon Valley, okay? It's about self-empowerment. And, like, using the money that's already under the, like, everywhere you go in Silicon Valley, right, you go to Google or Yahoo or anywhere, like, those businesses are so big, they kind of create their own ecosystem. Mm. And under that same ecosystem, there's, like, guys who mow the lawn. There's, like, Bon Appetit who goes and does the catering every day, right? Well, why don't somebody, which is kind of what I'm doing now, is, like, make your own self own worker-owned business in that economy and have you be like the industry standard that they come to you just do the same thing they're doing today, but just like it's a worker-owned business now. And then they can expand the, you know, it helps expand the economy because you're going to pay these people living wages instead of like, you know, $12 an hour or whatever.
And what kind of work do you do?
Oh, well, I'm a site supervisor at like a, but I can't really say because I'm getting ready to take his business away from him.
Okay.
But, like, what I do is, like, I sit there and I tell these guys to perform a service, and, like, we get paid a lot of money to do this simple service, and, like, we could do it. So, like, why not, like, do that, like, all around for, like, all these little subsets, like the lawnmowers? Why aren't they their own business? You know? And that would, you know, you could, like, to spread the money around, and that would create different views because you're going to work for a democratic business in a capitalist America. You know, so that would, like, teach your own employees, like, you know, how democracy works.
Right. Well, thank you for calling in, George. Rob, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, are we talking about the sort of economic ripple effects of Silicon Valley?
Right.
I mean, sort of broadly. You know, I mean, this is, the ecosystem is one of those terms you hear, you know, from when I go from meeting to meeting, whether it's Sand Hill Plaza in Menlo Park or up to San Francisco. It's not one of those terms you hear outside of the ecosystem, as it were, of Silicon Valley. I find it quite funny because it's often, there's an element to it that is correct, which is you have all sorts of people engaged in the same sort of business. And even the guys who mow the lawns and even the guys who do the catering, and they're all connected and they all work to each other and they all have their ideas and they help each other along. In fact, I think it's one of the reasons, frankly, in our profession, journalism, you have a fair amount of a lack of critical analysis of the industry itself. Everybody's sort of boosting each other in a way that quite doesn't happen on Wall Street, where everybody is butchering each other. But you know, that also does have an impact on the in the way people politically think. So again, this notion, I mean, Silicon Valley was built on the idea, on a very idealistic idea, right? So very much on this, you look back at this whole Earth catalog concept and, the, you know, read the Steve Jobs biography by Walter Isaacson. There is a sort of hippy-dippy sense that we can do anything that still permeates the place and the ecosystem, as it were. And I do think that that filters into the politics. So for now, that's why you have, broadly speaking, 2-to-1 donations being a symptom or emblematic of that towards Democrats, who tend to be a little bit more, I don't know, idealistic, I think, you know, or at least in their approach. But it's why I think that you will see this change over time as disaffection for both parties grows and the likes of the Andreessens or more so the Peter Thiels take over.
And what are your thoughts, Michelle? What would you like to add?
I was a little fuzzy on the question, but I understand that he was asking about the kind of the ecosystem of the valley, but I'm a little unclear. But I just wanted to point out one thing that I think that helps the Wall Street story, Wall Street in terms of story, in terms of reporters, is that Wall Street firms like to use policy and each other's missteps to bash each other over the head. And that is happening, starting to happen in a big way in Silicon Valley. So the industry does have some issues that are, it can be a monolith about, you know, some things that it does agree on. There's a lot going on competitively to use policy, federal policy issues to hurt each other. And one big area is antitrust. Another area is patents. So I think that this is great for reporters because you've got each side making really spending resources and making accusations about the behavior of others and talking to reporters, but more importantly, talking to regulators. So that has made the Silicon Valley political story way more interesting.
All right. And I think he was talking about spinning off businesses to try to make it more democratic or taking the business away from the .com to provide it yourself. I hope I got that right, George. Thank you for calling in. And I also wanted to talk about some of the names that are not household names. So beyond Mark Zuckerberg, for example, of Facebook, according to federal and state election records, Elon Musk, CEO of the electric car maker Tesla Motors, is the largest single donor among Silicon Valley's corporate officers. He's given about $336,000 to dozens of candidates since 2008. He gave both Governor Jerry Brown and Meg Whitman $25,900 each for their 2010 runs for governor. That's the maximum amount allowed by law. Do you both know anything about Elon Musk? What can you tell us about him? Rob?
I think the fact that he's given to both, I mean, that's quite funny, right? So he's
right.
I think that's actually, he's a very savvy businessman. I mean, the best way to play politics is to play with whoever's going to be winning at the time, to whoever's in charge. I think there is the idea that you put a red or a chip on Jerry Brown and on Meg Whitman suggests that whoever's in power, you want to make sure you have a relationship with them. And, you know, that is, that's just good business sense, I guess. But Elon, if I'm not mistaken, he's South African,
right?
And so his interest in politics, my guess, is less ideological and more strategic.
Right, but you're seeing this a lot, though. A lot of heavy hitters give to both candidates or both parties, as we talked about before. But they, in some cases, they give them both equal amounts.
Yeah. I mean, they know how to hedge their bets.
Right.
They're good at this stuff. And for Elon Musk, of course, there are some policy issues that he's probably going to be interested in, whether it's, CAFE standards for cars and things like that, because his great new startup is, of course, Tesla, the electronic car manufacturer. So he certainly will have an interest in whether it's, making it more, carbon taxes or increasing the availability of charging stations. All that stuff does matter to him and his business. So the extent to which whoever runs California or even on a national scale, somewhere else, he's got a line into them. Makes sense from his business perspective. But again, you could argue this is all about why our political system is, say, a bit corrupt.
And that is Rob Cox. He's editor of Breaking Views, the global financial commentary service of Reuters in New York. He's also a contributor to Newsweek. You can find his latest piece, which got a lot of attention because of this headline, "The Ruthless Overlords of Silicon Valley," at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Michelle Quinn, a Silicon Valley-based technology correspondent for Politico. Her latest piece is "Silicon Valley Pushes Policy Goals." And now I would like to welcome Jeffrey Ernst Friedman to the show. Jeffrey is a research director at MapLight, where he oversees the accuracy and timeliness of their data. They're a nonpartisan organization that reveals money's influence in politics. Hi, Jeffrey. Welcome to the show. Hello, Jeffrey. I'm sorry. We're having some technical problems today. So why don't we talk a little bit about differences? Are there major differences between these companies, Michelle, say between a Facebook and a Google?
In terms of policy?
In terms of policy and what's at the top of their list.
Let me think about that for a second. You know, some things Rob mentioned, one being tax repatriation. You hear that mostly from the hardware guys, the sort of traditional tech companies. And that's basically they've got foreign earnings they want to bring back here, but they don't want it to be taxed at whatever the percentage is, which is like 33%. President Obama's made it clear that isn't going to happen. So they are kind of retreating on that issue. But both companies want, both kind of all the pan industry, there's a push for changing immigration laws so that it'd be easier to move either existing employees or hiring new employees from other countries to the U.S. To work for these firms. So I think they're kind of consistent on that. And I'm trying to think about where they're different. I mean, privacy. We haven't talked about privacy at all.
Right.
And that's one area where I think companies, and including Apple, Facebook, Google, all the small app makers in Silicon Valley are really paying attention to Congress as well as the federal regulators. And they, I think in general, the feeling is, you know, do no harm. So there's a situation where they're working to try to stop something from happening. Likewise, on the issue of copyright, and Rob mentioned that as well. So we had the big thing that happened in January called SOPA, which is a House bill called Stop Online Privacy Act. And the tech industry succeeded in a few days, if not one day, stopping a bill from happening.
Yes, but you notice the funny thing is, of course, it wasn't the Google and whatnot who turned off their, who went black. It was the nonprofit folks like Wikipedia,
mm-hmm.
whose bottom line wouldn't have been affected by that blackout. That they basically kind of did this whole thing for the industry. But it totally shocked. I think you're right, Michelle. It totally shocked the folks on the Hill. I mean, if you look at Christopher Dodd, who, you know, used to be Connecticut senator and now chairs the Motion Pictures Association, Motion Picture Association of America, which had supported SOPA and it's sort of, I think there was another one called PIPA, Protect Intellectual Property Act. He called it the greatest backlash I've ever seen in my career. So people had no idea that all of a sudden Silicon Valley, this place, this benign place that created nice little gadgets, all of a sudden could, you know, rise up and freak out all of Congress and turn off, the internet and the Google webs for America. I think it scared the life out of Congress. And both bills were basically pulled, even though they had been basically agreed in committee, I think.
Right. And I think I just want to counter a little bit that I felt like what Google did was pretty dramatic. Yes, they didn't turn off Google, but they slapped a black tape over
right.
a logo. And I know that that's not the same as turning it off, but I thought that was unbelievably dramatic in terms of saying, you know, it's almost like, you know, if you, I don't even remember the Magritte, or there's like famous photos of like a black tape over your mouth. It's mm-hmm. saying we're not speaking. And I don't know, I thought that was a kind of a shocking thing to do with their logo and their brand for one day, but I don't know how many people saw that. I'm sure there's figures out there.
Yeah, we did a show about that. And also, the fact is a lot of politicians really had no idea what the law would actually do. And they got a very fast lesson because of the calls to Capitol Hill. In fact, people shut down the phone service because there was so much outrage over that. Let's go to our next caller. Let's hear from KDF in Oakland. Hi, KDF. Thanks for holding.
Oh, no problem. My question is theoretical, but your guests may be able to come up with a figure after the show and you could post it. What percentage of Silicon Valley's most profitable companies' profits would they each have to donate directly into the California public school system to make California number one per pupil in expenditure rather than 47th as it is now? It's a personal question because when I moved here at 10 years old 55 years ago today, our school system was so good. The floors were so clean and waxed, it used to make me sneeze every Monday when I came in after the weekend. We had fabulous resources for the schools and the teachers, and now look at us. And shouldn't Silicon Valley be embarrassed to have all these riches and to basically not care about the public school system?
I'd love to answer that. Oh, this is Michelle.
Yes.
Well, I don't know the answer to the number, so that would take some research. But I think that the Silicon Valley companies would say, and forgive me if I get this wrong, as any company representatives are listening, that, they do care about the schools, the public school system, the university system in California, but they also have a job to do, which is to play by the rules of society, and that includes tax laws, and that the fault or the responsibility lies with lawmakers in California, in the feds, and that a company like Apple, so Apple was just written up in the New York Times in a really amazing piece about kind of the tax rules that they play by, so that a lot of tax or some percentage of taxable income goes to Nevada. And they quoted, the story quoted, like, the president of De Anza College saying, you know, I know they drive by here. I know that their employees, maybe there's some of their cousins go here or their sisters or brothers. Why would they do this? And I believe Apple's quote in that story is, you know, we are playing with we legally pay our taxes, and this is what we do, is to figure out how best to protect the rights, the interests of the shareholders. So that kind of interest of shareholders theme is sort of what Rob hits on. But, you know, I think the companies would push back and say, you Californians, you lawmakers in California, you need to change. If you want us to play by different rules, fine, we'll do it. But it's not up to us to kind of write a check. And by the way, we probably do write some checks.
Well, and this is an important point, because you're talking about a company that's sitting on $100 billion in cash.
Right.
And according to this piece, by putting an office in Reno, just 200 miles away from Cupertino, their headquarters, Apple sidesteps state income taxes. So California's corporate rate is 8.84%, and Nevada's is zero. And so in addition to this, I mean, this is related. We did a show with the California Tax Association a couple of months ago, and they've got this very in-depth report that hardly gets any mention in Sacramento or D.C. called High Tech, Low Tax, How the Richest Silicon Valley Corporations Pay Incredibly Low Taxes on Their Land. So, Rob, how do you make sense of these issues?
Well, it's a very good point. And from Katie, I mean, this is it's a travesty that we are. And it's not just Silicon Valley. I mean, I live in Connecticut, and you see the same thing. We have General Electric, some of the biggest defense companies, insurance companies, and yet we have schools that are absolutely failing. Two blocks away from Goldman Sachs, you can find schools that are failing. That is a policy question, and we have just put bad policy upon bad policy, particularly when it comes to tax code in this country. You know, state and local and government tax codes are completely wrong. And so Apple is doing absolutely everything it should do by its shareholders. The directors and the people who work there have a fiduciary obligation to maximize profits. That's what corporations do. That's what General Electric does when it pays 9% on an annual tax basis and gets ridiculed vilified the New York Times for doing so. But at the end of the day, they're just doing what our kerflooey tax code allows them to do. But again, it goes back to my original point. Apple, Facebook, Google, they are companies, they're corporations. They may say that they're different and they're not conventional and they're meant to do good with their products and that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, they are public companies that need to answer their shareholders and compete with other for the money of investors all around the world. And they are going to maximize their profits. So, I mean, I can't blame Apple or any of these guys for doing what the laws allow them to do to maximize their bottom lines. I mean, that's the rules of the road. They're following them. The rules are wrong, I would argue, on 10,000 different fronts. But I don't think we can vilify them for that. And then there is another question, which is it's not necessarily the corporation's fault that these guys are still providing tons of jobs, creating huge amounts of wealth in these areas. If the schools are falling apart, I mean, that's just that's just shameful.
Well, and also, here we've got news today. Twitter just officially opened in San Francisco, I believe today or possibly yesterday. They're valued at $8 billion. They received a payroll tax exemption from the city of San Francisco valued at $22 million. And their argument was, hey, if you tax us, we can go somewhere else and bring jobs into that community, and we're going to what they call revitalize our market in Sixth Area, which has a lot of, you know, rundown buildings, peep shows, homeless, you name it. But the fear is that they're going to push these people out, and, you know, what happens to them? Because they've got these fancy new digs now, rooftop garden, yoga rooms, cafeterias. So we'll definitely have to do a show about what this means. If you come into a city and say, give us a tax break and we will offer you benefits in return, you know, what is the outcome there?
I guess, Rose, the only thing I would say is that's really for the city of San Francisco. That's their problem, in a way. I mean, I realize that the benefit is accruing to the company and to the yoga aficionados at that place. But ultimately, the city of San Francisco has decided to take taxpayers' money,
right,
you know, and give it to a company. They need to have a quid pro quo. And it's got to be a robust one, particularly in an environment like we have now all around, and particularly in California, where, you know, states and local governments are going bust. You know, their numbers don't add up.
I would add something to the Twitter issue, which is somebody who's been in the area for more than 20 years. There's not a lot of tech in San Francisco. It's been one of the weirdest puzzles of the whole place is that, you know, the tech industry's been 40 miles south in Palo Alto and south. And it's strange to me that, like, companies like Google, YouTube, which is part of Google, Facebook, which are really advertising-centric, are not in San Francisco. So I think that it's time for, you know, the city it's a place where a lot of people want to live.
Right. I think a lot of it has to do with space.
A lot of it has to do with space, but I think it's whatever the reason is. No one knew about this kind of the payroll tax issue that would be on stock holdings until it came up last year. I think that what the city has to do is how can it keep companies? Is it just an incubator for 1 or 2, 10-people companies, or is it a place where, you know, bigger companies can really take root? And that seems to be one of the issues. And then, as is always the case in San Francisco, you have to ask, you know, what cost?
Right.
Land is at a premium.
Well, we're getting a lot of emails on this issue, specifically what role do the companies play when it comes to paying their fair share, and what happens, like you said, Rob, when you've got these crumbling schools in their backyards. And now I'd like to go to our next guest, Jeffrey Ernst Friedman, Research Director at MapLight. Hi, Jeffrey. I'm sorry. We've been having some technical problems today.
That's quite all right.
We just have a couple of minutes, but I wanted to ask you, what really stands out for you when you're looking at how much Silicon Valley companies are giving to campaigns and super PACs? What makes them different?
I think it's what makes them different is that it's a new industry, and that's just something that's been developing over the last 5, 10 years compared to, the movie industry, which has been around for decades and, you know, perhaps longer. So I think what we're seeing is we haven't really quite seen how these industries are going to align with political groups and whether it'll firmly fit into one party versus another. And I think, as was brought up earlier about SOPA and TIPA, is that, you know, these groups kind of announced their arrival on the scene, and I believe that the two political parties, are starting to see that there is an influence, and with that influence comes campaign contributions, and they're going to start bending their policies to kind of fit this new ideology that they're introducing into their political spectrum.
And you just, what are your thoughts on this year? Because this 2012 election is expected to cost between $6 and $7 billion across the board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was brought up earlier. You know, it's definitely Barack Obama comes into the area and collects, tens of millions of dollars, and then goes out and starts to, show ads in other states. So this is kind mm-hmm. of a donor state for Democrats, where they can collect a lot of money and then go fight battles. Elsewhere, and how that will, you know, if it's, you know, doesn't continue, you know, in the future, it's because of whether these companies find that a successful strategy going forward. Does it make more sense to align with one political party or another is based on the outcomes, based on, you know, whatever their corporate mandate that was brought up, their fiduciary responsibility going forward. So I think that's what we're going to see is it's pretty much this is going to be the first marker, and as we go forward with midterm elections and future presidential elections, we get to see, you know, does it stay with a particular ideology that fits with Silicon Valley and California more liberal, or is it bent, does it begin to drift more towards kind of the East Coast Wall Street type mentality?
Huh. Oh, yeah, that'll be interesting to watch. Michelle, what are your thoughts? What do you think we'll see in the next couple of months?
Well, I was just wondering, thinking about this as well, which is depending on how, if there are no social issues that come up in this presidential election, if Mitt Romney just kind of focuses narrowly on the economy and doing more to free up whatever for corporate America and innovation, if he hits the innovation economy theme, then I'll be really interested in seeing kind of what happens in terms of votes, just pure, like, you know, how the Valley does, but also in terms of PAC giving and then the months leading up to the election. Because I think that Silicon Valley is a really democratic place. I think it tends to be more, you know, the top echelon of the, you know, in terms of the leadership, maybe more conservative. But I don't know, somebody said to me that, you know, the natural position of the Republican Party is pro-corporate, more freedom, and that may be the natural direction that more mature tech companies go to. And if you don't have social issues like gay marriage or immigration that kind of rile up people in an emotional way beyond kind of what's good for my company, then maybe Silicon Valley will do better.
And Rob, final thoughts? We've got about 20 seconds.
It's an interesting thing to look at. So if you think of Carly Fiorina, who's now, you know, on one of the very, very long short lists, albeit for Romney's campaign as a sort of person, you know, possible CEO you bring in to do something. Or you look at Meg Whitman, or you look at John Chambers, who's a big Republican supporter. As these companies mature, they become more corporate. And again, they start to behave like corporations and go, to my point earlier, they behave like business as usual.
Well,
like, don't be evil.
Well, we'll definitely follow this. Rob Cox, contributing editor to Newsweek, a contributor to Newsweek. Michelle Quinn, correspondent with Politico, and Jeffrey Ernst Friedman, research director at MapLight. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. It's Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. Are we consuming digital technology, or is it consuming us? On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we had with Jason Ben-Levy, author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech, Secrets They Won't Tell You About Your Digital Life. He believes that tech companies serve their own agenda before serving yours. Do you have concerns about who controls your digital technology? Is concentrated control affecting our democracy? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.